We are learning Parashat Mishpatim. That's the Parashat HaShavua. The Parashat of the laws, most of the monetary laws. If you count the mitzvot in this week's Parashat, is 53. 42 of them have to do between man and his fellow man. And those are the Mishpatim that are presented. The Pasuk says, Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehim. These are the statutes, or these are the laws that you should place in front of them. I was studying this Pasuk over the past week, and I analyzed every word. Ve'ele is these, although there's a vav over there. Vav means, and these are the laws. I wouldn't have started, when we were in school, they told us you don't start a sentence with and. I don't know if that's grammatically correct. I know a lot of great writers that do start their sentences with and. The Torah, the greatest writer of them all, had no problem with it. It starts the parasha with and these are the laws. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim. Question is, what is the and doing over there? It must be connecting it to something. Whenever there's a vav, the vav connects to something that's before. Ve'ele, and also, and these are the mishpatim. So you probably have to look what's written right before it to see if there's any sort of connection. So I did that. And the law that's written right before this mishpatim, ve'ele mishpatim, is the end of last week's parasha, which talks about the laws of the mizbeach. The mizbeach is the altar. The Torah tells us that two laws. Number one, it was made out of stone, and you weren't allowed to use metal to cut the stone. The Torah tells us that metal is used for weapons, and it wouldn't be proper to use something that's used to kill in order to build a mizbeach that's used to add life to people. You don't make from the prosecutor the defense. So that's the law. And it says also that the Mizbeach, you're not allowed to build steps going up to the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach was high up. You need to build a ramp. Pasuk says, Velo ta'ale b'ma'alot al Mizbechi. You're not allowed to make the ascension to the Mizbeach from steps. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim. And these are the laws. I said to myself, what could be the connection between the Mizbeach and the laws? Seemingly, there is no connection. Well, if I had to say a simple connection, I would say that where were the offices of the Sanhedrin? We had a high court. Our Supreme Court was called Sanhedrin. And they had an office. They were the ones that were in charge of executing the law. All these mishpatim were done by the courts. And our main court had its offices in Jerusalem, on the Temple Mount, next to the Mizbeach. So therefore, the Torah might be giving us the connection between the Mizbeach and the Mishpatim. The fact that it's connecting them is telling us that that's where their location is. And for good reason. The Supreme Court of the United States has its offices in Washington, D.C. They have their own building, the judicial building, the Justice, Department of Justice. Because the American justice system is a secular system. It's got nothing to do with religion. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the country has a rule of separation of church and state. And the church has nothing to do with the state and vice versa. Therefore, it's put in the place where the government is, right across the street from the Congress and the Senate. But Jewish law is not secular. Jewish law is the law of God. Therefore, the Jewish court is a holy institution. And therefore it belongs in the holiest place on the Temple Mount. The law belongs to God. We don't believe in a separation of church and state. The state must be bound by the church, by its church. I don't mean church. I mean by the religion, by Judaism, by the Torah. So therefore, since it's a religious institution, it has to have its offices in the holiest place. That's a simple connection. But there might be yet another connection between it. Rashi tells us Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. You must place the law in front of the people. It's a strange way of saying it. I would have said, teach the law to the people. But do you place a law in front of a people? Well, if you're in a restaurant and you have a table in front of you, they place the food in front of you. And they prepare a table in front of you. You place an entree in front of a guest, but do you place a law so that she comes along and he says right away, Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. By the way, I don't want to plagiarize. Rashi himself is the one that says, Lama nismecha parashat dinim neparashat mizbeach. Why are the laws written next to the mizbeach? Lomar lecha shetasim sanhedrin etzel hamikdash. To teach you to put the office of the Sanhedrin next to the temple. So we give credit where credit is due. Rashi then says, Asher tasim lifnehem, place it in front of them. So he writes, Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMoshe, God says to Moses, Lo ta'ale al da'techa, don't think that you're just going to teach them the dry law. I'll teach it to them two or three times until they remember the law. And I won't toil myself to give them the logic of the law and the rationale of the law. He says, don't do that. Lekach ne'emar asher tasim lifnehem, place it in front of them, kishulhan aruch, like a table that's set. Umuchan le'echol lifnei ha'adam. So he understood it that exactly the law must be presented like you present a table with food on it to the guests. That everything has to be clear and tasty and have proper optics. The same thing of the law. The law cannot be a dry law. When the rabbi explains the law to the people, it has to be presented in an appetizing way. Like you would present something on a table where it's clear, where the student doesn't walk away and say, I heard what he said, but I'm not too sure what the law wants from me. There has to be kishulhan aruch, like a table that's set, tasim lifnehem. Imagine you're presenting a delicacy of food in front of somebody. Present the law in the same appetizing way. That's the way that she learns. Just a word of what the Kli Yakar said. There was a rabbi called the Kli Yakar. I have it in front of me, as a matter of fact. He says, one of the reasons why you're not allowed to build the mizbeach with steps, even though that's a very practical way, you go up steps and you get to the mizbeach. He says, no, because steps can lead to arrogance. Steps can lead to arrogance. I never knew that before. What do steps and ego have in common? He says, well, when there's steps, then people want to show their strength. So you see them running up the steps. I had one rabbi, he wasn't arrogant at all, but he wanted to show me his strength. I was young, and we used to learn on the third floor of a building. And he used to, you know, run up the steps, and his feet would extend four steps at a time. He would do the whole stairwell in, you know, six different moves, and he was already on the top. Well, again, he wasn't arrogant, but the Torah tells us that the concept of going up on the steps, people want to show their strength. So the Torah says, no steps. By the Mizbeach, it must be humility. We cannot build anything in its construction that could lead to some sort of arrogance by the Kohen. Therefore, build a ramp. And more difficult to run up a ramp. You can't skip steps. You have to run up, you have to walk up straight or on the incline. So the Kli Yakar says the lesson of the Mizbeach is humility. Now I'll tell you a story in Jewish history. There was a rabbi that lived in Sfat about 500 years ago. His name was Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo had an idea to take all Jewish law and to write it in a book. He felt that the law was being forgotten. People weren't clear on what is demanded of them. And there's no source for them to go to. In those days, if you wanted to know Jewish law, you had to go to the Talmud. And you had to read a whole page of Talmud and then try to figure out what does God want from you. So it was difficult for the people. So he had a novel idea. And he decided to write all the Jewish law in a book. And of course, you know what he named the book. He named the book Shulchan Aruch, the set table. And the reason why he names the book the set table is because of the Rashi in this week's parasha. Because God says, Torah must be like a set table, that it's easy for the people that are at the table to eat. That everything is in front of them. That it's accessible. So he names the book Shulchan Aruch, and he divides it into four sections, which basically cover all practical Jewish law. At the same time, two other rabbis were working on the same project. This is what Rav Hida tells us in his book called Shema Gedolim. One of the rabbis was called Rav Yosef Taitzak. He was also a Sadiq. He was born in Spain, in Castile. And he moved also to Saloniki. And he was working on a project as well, also a Shulchan Aruch. And there was a third rabbi called Maharival, Rabbi Yosef ben Lev, who was a great, great Talmid Chacham and Rosh Yeshiva in Turkey. And he was also working on a Shulchan Aruch. So you have three rabbis simultaneously had the same idea to produce the same product. So Rav Hida said he has a tradition. Why then was Rav Yosef Karo's book accepted? What happened to the other rabbi? Where are those books? Those books did not make it to the forefront in the Jewish library. What zichut did Rav Yosef Karo have in order that his Shulchan Aruch is the one that's accepted as law in all Klal Yisrael, Sephardim, Ashkenazim? So he says, because Rabbi Yosef Karo, out of all the three rabbis, possessed a tremendous amount of humility. And you see it in his writings. He always took opinions, and he brings all the opinions down, and even opinions that he argued on and did not accept, he does it with great respect. He humbles himself in front of the rabbis above him. The language that he uses in his book is very, very soft and very gentle. He himself was quite humble, and therefore, because of his humility, his book was accepted. So I added them, that he fulfilled exactly the connection between the Mizbeach and the Mishpatim. The Pasuk says, "Ve'lo ta'ale b'ma'alot al Mizbechi." Don't run up the Mizbeach. Do not be arrogant. And if you won't be arrogant, ve'ele ha'mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, you will have the merit to place the Mishpatim in front of the people. And as she says, "Keshulhan aruch." The Shulchan Aruch's merit was because he was like the Mizbeach. It's not enough to be a good legislator to write law. But the Torah demands a good personality as well. The Torah does not measure only the IQ of the Talmid Chacham and his acumen. The Torah measures the decency of the Talmid Chacham and his midot. And Rabbi Yosef Karo had both. And therefore, since he portrayed the midah of the Mizbeach, which is pure anava, he ends up getting ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim to write the Shulchan Aruch, and that it should be accepted. There's not a bet midrash in the world that does not have this Shulchan Aruch. I will tell you something else that's not so well known about the Shulchan Aruch. It's four volumes. It takes years to study it. Very, very, very long book. It's a big book. But it's not so well known that when he wrote the book, it was supposed to be studied as part of a 30-day program. You know, like they have those books today, you know, you read one page a day or something, and 30 days you finish the book. He wrote the Shulchan Aruch, and on the cover page, I saw this by Rabbi Yaakov Eleazar once, he showed me the original Shulchan Aruch. And the front page it says, a 30-day program. And like the Tehillim, they break it up into 30 days. So you would learn, I don't know, 50, 60 pages, and he would say, okay, day two on top. And then 30 pages, day three. Could you imagine, in those days, they were capable to learn the entire Shulchan Aruch in 30 days? Today, if a guy does it in 30 years, you say, wow, well, that's a great accomplishment. To become a rabbi, you don't have to know everything in Shulchan Aruch. You just don't need to know the highlights. And they give you a simicha. But to study it from cover to cover and to do it in 30 days, it seems clearly it's true that we have what's called Yiridat HaDorot. The generations obviously are regressing. So that's just one tidbit of information at the beginning of our parasha. So the word lifnehem means presented to them, kishulchan aruch, like you would present a meal in front of a guest, where there's an order to the meal. The soup comes first, and then the salad, and then the entree, and then the dessert. Everything is in order, that it makes sense. Therefore, Torah must be written in such a way where it's Shulchan Aruch, where the rabbi's job is not to confuse the student, it's in order to take away the fogginess and give him clarity. And that's incumbent upon a rabbi to prepare the shiurim properly, to give it over in the clearest way possible. Kishulchan Aruch. But there's another interpretation when it says Lifnehem. Lifnehem doesn't only mean present it to them like you would present a table set with food, but Rashi says Lifnehem velo lifne goyim. Jewish law says that we are not allowed to go to secular courts. Two Jews are having an argument amongst each other, which is okay, but they must go and settle it in a beddin. Beddin is a Jewish court. The law bans us from taking our arguments and our quarrels to secular courts. What is a secular court? Well, clearly, a court in the United States that's not, that's run by the government, whether it's a federal court or a local court, whatever it may be, state court, all that's considered secular. Of course, we have to respect the laws of the land. But our quarrels must be dealt with internally, with hakamim. But not only in America. If you go to the land of Israel, they also have a court system. They have courts and they have judges. I'm sorry to tell you, I'm embarrassed to tell you, that the court system that's set up in Eretz Israel is a secular court. Now, even though the judges might be Jewish, even though they speak Hebrew, even though some of them might be wearing yarmulkes on their heads, you say, oh, this is a bedin, what more do you want? Jewish judges, kippahs on their heads, some of them, and they speak Lashon HaKodesh. However, it's a secular court because the law that they follow is based on British law. It's not based on Torah law, even though it's in the land of Israel. So could you imagine, I mean, the desecration of God's name? That here we have our land that has a court system that does not follow the Torah rulings. They rule against what the Torah says. Sometimes they might rule what the Torah says, but that's just by chance. Then they don't intend to rule like the Torah. So if you live in Israel, it would be forbidden also to bring your quarrels to a secular court in Eretz Israel. It applies in both places. The irony, however, in Eretz Israel is the following. What is our right to the land of Israel? What gives us a right to this land more than anybody else? Do we have a lease? Do we have some sort of documentation that says that this land belongs to us? We do. It's called the Torah. So you took the Torah and you use that Torah as proof that the land belongs to you in order that you could build a court system. And then when it came to the rules of that court system, you took the Torah and said, thank you, I don't need you anymore. I just needed you to get possession of the territory. Once I got possession of the territory, now I'll do what I want to do. You can't use the book when you want to use the book, and then when it's not convenient for you to use the book, you discard it. So the pasuk clearly says, "Ve'ella mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, lifnehem ve'lo negoyim." Goyim doesn't mean necessarily Gentiles; it means secular court. And Achamim say that it's a big hilul Hashem and a big disgrace when we take our quarrels outside for a few reasons. The main reason is. As I told you, we believe that Beit Din is a holy institution. It's a religious institution. It says that when people go to court, the Shekhinah is in the court. That's why the litigants must stand in the court in front of the judge. Not because they have to stand in front of the judge, because the Shekhinah is in the court. Of course, in American law, they say, you know, when the judge walks in, they stand up. They got that from us. But we're not standing up necessarily for the judge, we're standing up for God that's in the courtroom. So imagine we opt to leave the holy institution that has God. And in that institution, God allows us to swear on His holy name. We swear on God's name in Beit Din. And we instead go to a secular place where God is not found. That's not Hilul Hashem. That's not saying Tagar Chas B'Shalom that we're not interested in His presence. Imagine leaving the synagogue and going somewhere else. Today, unfortunately, we see something similar, which was a pet peeve of my rabbi, Hacham Baruch Alav Hashalom, as well as I inherited that pet peeve as well. The Shekhinah is found in the synagogue. But today we have many of our community members that opt to make minyanim in their homes. The Shekhinah is not in the Jewish home as it is in the synagogue. So even though it might be convenient, because instead of having to walk 3 or 4 blocks to the synagogue, so you make a minyan in the house, it's very convenient, I don't say no. But it's not a bet kineset. So do away with the institution of synagogues. What do we build synagogues for? Let's just build homes, and everybody will build an extension in the house, and we'll make a minyanim. It cannot replace a synagogue. It's the same thing. The rabbi was very upset because he believed that it's better when everybody comes together in one synagogue, but of Amadrat Melech, in a place that has more kiddushah than just a regular home. But that's the second interpretation of Lifnehem. So far I said two interpretations. Lifnehem, present it properly. Lifnehem. The second interpretation, Lifnehem, but not Lifneguim. Now I'd like to say a third interpretation. I have 70 interpretations, God willing, to say today. Just as long as you keep track. What are we up to? Number 3? Okay, what time is it? We're okay. Number 3. What I'm telling you now comes from a rabbi called Rav Hida, Rabbeinu Chaim Yosef David Azulai. Moshe Rabbeinu went up to heaven in order to get the Torah. And it says the angels were there holding a protest rally. What are they protesting? We don't want to give the Torah to humans. The Torah must remain in heaven. God told Moshe, well, you have your work cut out for you. The angels are not making it easy. Give them an answer why they don't deserve the Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes to them and says, listen, angels, the Torah says don't steal. Does that apply to you? The Torah says don't murder. Does that apply to you? All the laws in Parashat Mishpatim, don't lend money with interest. When you find the lost object, you have to return it. When you see your friend's animal needs loading, help him load the animal. Those laws don't apply to you. So therefore, how do you ask for a law that has no application for you? That was Moshe's claim to the angels. God tells the angels, what do you have to say for yourself? And so that's it, we surrender. Give the Torah to Moshe. And I ask, and Hida asks a simple question. He says, what was the claim of the angels? Do they have a legal claim that the Torah should be by them? They must have a legal claim. I mean, you can't just say, it's mine. You can't come into court and say, it's mine. What's your right to say it's yours? What's your legal claim? So he says the legal claim, as we discussed in previous shiurim, but I'm saying it differently today, the claim of Bar Metzra. You know what Bar Metzra is? Bar Metzra says, if somebody has a house and he wants to sell the house, he must give rights of first refusal to the neighbor. There's a rule. Somebody comes along and says, I want to buy a house. You say, I might sell it to you. I got to go to the neighbor first. If the neighbor refuses, then you go to the outsider. Why? It's a Torah law. The Torah says, because that's the right thing to do. That's considered just. Why is it just? Because the neighbor has a bigger advantage to own the house that's next to him than somebody else. The neighbor can extend his house. He can knock the house down and build a yard for himself. It's always better for a person to extend his own property. With this guy, what do you care? You can buy the same property somewhere else. So since there's an advantage to the neighbor to have the property next to him, he gets rights of first refusal. That's the law. So the angels came to Moshe Rabbeinu and said, hey, God's selling the Torah now. We have two buyers. You came from planet Earth. The Torah has been living next to us for 974 generations. We've been the neighbor of the Torah since the beginning. And therefore, as the neighbor, we're invoking Torah law that says the neighbor gets first rights. And we're not giving up our rights. The Torah remains by us. Oh, that's already a legal claim. So what's Moshe Rabbeinu's claim back? Don't steal. Does that apply to you? Lend with interest. Don't murder. What was his claim back? So I'll tell you the claim back. It was an amazing claim back. I want to ask you a question. I believe you'll get it right. It's a lucky question. Guy selling his house. He has a buyer, not the neighbor. The buyer says, I'll give you market value. Market value is $1 million. You have it, I'll give you $1 million. He says, well, wait, I got to go to the neighbor first. He goes to the neighbor. The neighbor says, oh, I want it. I'll give you $500,000. Halakha says, you don't have to lose money by selling it to the neighbor. You're only obligated to sell it to the neighbor if he's willing to pay fair market value. Because if the Torah is just, it has to be just on both sides. I mean, the neighbor has a right to ask for the house, but the seller doesn't have an obligation to lose money because he wants to be a nice guy. That's the law. Watch what Hidas says, how brilliant he says. He says, there's four interpretations to every pasuk in the Torah. Those four interpretations are called pardes. Pshat is the literal interpretation. And then the other three interpretations are like esoteric. It takes the pasuk out of its natural interpretation and says, you know, dirashot, ideas, concepts, especially the Kabbalah, it's concepts. An angel cannot explain the Torah literally. He only can explain the Torah in three out of the four ways, because he cannot explain don't steal literally. Don't steal doesn't apply to him. Don't kill in its literal interpretation has no application. But if you learn that, no, it's concepts, so then it applies. So they only have three out of four interpretations. Whereas the Jews, we are able to have all four. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes and says, hold it. If God's selling, if he sells to you, he loses, because you can only pay three interpretations. We're able to pay four interpretations. Therefore, the law goes, it comes to us. You're not willing to pay full price for the Torah. You're only going to interpret it on three levels. And therefore, the angels don't deserve it. So it comes out, because of the laws in this week's parasha, we get the Torah and the angels don't. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim. It is these laws, asher tasim lifnehem, that the Haida says, lifnehem to the Jews, velo lifnehem malachim. You give it in front of the Jews and not in front of the angels, because we have the mishpatim. And since they can only explain the mishpatim in derashot, they can only explain the mishpatim in the air, in concept, but they can't explain it in reality, in pshat, they're only willing to pay three. We're willing to pay four. You're not willing to pay fair market value. The Bar Mitzra has no claim. And therefore the Torah says, Lifnehem, the Torah belongs to the Jewish people. Velo lemalachim. So that's yet a third interpretation. I'll say a fourth one now as well. Bar Mitzra is a neighbor. Mitzra literally means a border. The one that shares the common border. Bar Mitzvah, Bar Mitzra, the one that shares the border, which we call a neighbor in the easy English. Fourth interpretation. And to me, this is a very important interpretation. I say it all the time. Now I'm going to say it in the Pasuk. Torah is a book of law. The Constitution of the United States is also document of law. In the Constitution, it tells us certain things that we're allowed to do as Americans and certain things that are forbidden. And you always have to ask yourself, what is the major difference between the two documents? Between the Constitution of the United States and the Torah? Very simple. The main difference is the Constitution is written by man. It's a synthetic book. George Washington and his friends went to Philadelphia, and they went for a few months at a convention that they had. I learned this in school. And at a convention, they decided to write a document that's going to redefine the science of politics or the science of government. And they wrote this tremendous document. I don't say no, it's a tremendous document. I mean, we have a flag. You see how much I respect the Constitution. Whereas the Torah is not a man-made book, it's divine law, it's written by God. And that is a big difference. I'll tell you the difference. And the founding fathers of the United States recognized this difference. That's why I have a lot of respect for them. when they wrote that book in 1776, they understood that how could they write a law that's going to last for hundreds of years? Things change. Society changes. Values change. Morality changes. So they don't have an ability to forecast what the world's going to look like in 200 years from now. So basically they were only able to write their constitution based on the prevailing morals and values of the society that they lived in, and maybe a little further. But they understood that this book cannot endure for the duration of history because things change. How do I know that they recognized it? Because they put a provision in the Constitution, which is the Amendment Clause. The Amendment Clause says, listen, it's not a perfect document, although today it might be perfect. In a few years or 100 years from now, things might change and stuff that we wrote is not relevant, and maybe stuff that we should have wrote has to be added. So therefore we allow, you know, based on certain procedure, that if a society decides that the Constitution needs to be updated, you have a right to amend the document. Wow, to me that's humility. I believe that that's a proper, they understood that they're not God. And since that time, again, I'm not an expert, I think there's 29 amendments since 1776. In the 1920s, they said, you know what, it's time that we allow ladies to vote. Okay, how's that about it? Now you can vote. Who votes? Anybody vote? So now, which means they amended it. I guess at the time that they wrote it, it wasn't important for ladies to vote, or they didn't respect ladies in the proper way. Then they changed it, and then became proper. And they keep on making these amendments. I don't have a problem with it. A synthetic document always has to be upgraded, because when you write it, you cannot forecast what's going to be in the future. However, a document that's written by God, He knows what the future is going to be. So therefore, a document that's divine could be written for the duration of history. It does not lend itself to changes and to amendment. There's no amendment clause or elastic clause in the Torah. It doesn't say in the Torah that, listen, if in 2018, 70 rabbis come together with long beards and hats, and they come along and say, you know something, there's no more trichinosis anymore. It's been solved. Therefore, we're going to allow to eat pork. 70-0. And while we're at it, no more milk and meat, because the Gastronomy Society of Harvard told us that there's no more danger in eating milk and meat. Therefore, we're going to let that go as well. You have no right. The law was written by God, and therefore he knew the world's going to last for 6,000 years. So he forecasted every possibility that could ever happen, and he wrote a law that lasts forever. So you cannot amend it, you cannot change it. That's a big difference. Now, the way I'll explain the pasuk, I have two ways of explaining it based on this. The difference between our law and the secular law, the secular law could be changed because it was made by man. The Jewish law cannot be changed because the law comes before the judge. The law precedes the judge. In secular law, it's the judge that made the law. The pasuk says, "Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem." In Jewish law, the law comes before the judge. Asher tasim lifnehem means the law is higher than the one that enforces it. The one that enforces the law, you should know something comes before you. The law is above you. The judge has no right to change the law. In America, however, the Supreme Court does it all the time. They change laws. They change the interpretation of the Constitution. Whereas in Judaism, the Torah precedes. It comes lifnehem. When the judge comes into court in Jewish law, the law is there already from before you. Hashem tasim lifnehem. And therefore, you must respect the law as it is, and just your job is to interpret it, but not to modify it or change it. Now, go tell that to the Reform. Go tell that to the conservative. Go tell that to the Reconstructionists. That's all they do all day long. They come along and take the law and they say, well, this doesn't apply anymore. We're modern. We've advanced. Therefore, these things are archaic, and this is stale, and this is old, and this is, you know, outdated. Chas v'shalom. The law came before you, not vice versa. But somebody once asked me a question, and I'd like to explain this as well. Look at this. On one word, lifnehem, how many ideas come out of it? He asked me a question. He said, but Rabbi, how come you don't believe that the Torah has to be modified? So why should I say that? He says, because society evolves. And there's new phenomenon that are around today that was not around 3,500 years ago when the Torah was given. So therefore, I mean, I don't have any Pesukim Torah that talk about a microwave. And clearly there was no Wi-Fi at Har Sinai. And all these new technological questions that we have, how could you use an old law that did not have access to these phenomenon? You must advance the book. You must upgrade it. That was the question that they asked me. What's the answer to that question? Well, I'm going to tell you how to answer it. First of all, it's a fair question. They're saying, how could you use a book to answer modern questions when the book was written, these modern questions and phenomena did not exist? But if you follow the constitution law, so we adjust it, we upgrade it. You know, we have to keep it current. Why don't you allow the Torah to keep current? What's the answer to that? How would you answer that? I'll tell you how. The answer is, the Torah is not only a law book. The Zohar HaKadosh refers to the Torah as a blueprint. The language of the Zohar says, "Istakel be'oraita ubara alma." Anytime you build a building, so first you make a blueprint, you make a draft, and then you follow the blueprint, and then you construct. Well, guess what? This whole universe that you see is a building site. And if you look at the sign, it says, "Property of God." This is God's site, and He built this whole universe. But you need a blueprint. So the Zohar HaKadosh says He has a blueprint. That blueprint was the Torah. This book here, if you go through its pages and you know how to read it, everything in this blueprint eventually becomes part of this world. That's a very important principle, which means if you see the Empire State Building, and you go to the 90th floor, and you go to the back corridor, and there's a little hallway, an alcove. You say, hold it, I want to see the blueprints. You'll see that alcove on the blueprint. Because if it's in the building, it must be written somewhere on the blueprint, because the architect is following the design. Says the Hachamim of Zohar, if you see something in this world, it must be in the Torah. So you see microwaves in the Torah, in the world? Somewhere in the book. Open the draft pages of the Torah and you'll see it. Now you're not going to see it in a pasuk, microwave, but you're going to see principles that you're going to be able to apply to the new phenomenon. You're not going to find Wi-Fi, but you'll see something that will talk about another concept that has an application to the most modern cases. Even when they asked Chacham Avadya Yosef a very modern question, they told him, what is the Torah's opinion? And don't ask me for the answer of this. They asked him, what is the Torah's opinion of surrogate motherhood? Acham said, what is surrogate motherhood? We take the egg from the mother, we take the seed from the father, and we fertilize it outside the womb. Now, by the way, that's a modern question. You think 3,000 years ago in the Midbar, they had fertility, were they able to do these things outside of a womb? Of course not. Chacham Avadya says, and continue the question, well, Hakam, this mother, the natural mother, her insides cannot hold the baby. So we want to take this fertilized egg with its all of its fertility, and we want to put it in a stranger, a surrogate, and she'll be the basket, she'll carry the baby. And she'll deliver it, and then we'll give it back to the imam. Who's the legal mother of that baby? The ones that delivered the egg, or the one that carried it? Why? Moshe Rabbeinu done that surrogate motherhood? This is a new technology. Guess what? He wrote 10 pages all from the Torah, giving the Torah's opinion on it, clear as day. And you read the Tishrei, say, I don't believe this Torah. You thought that the only one that can answer this question is Yale. You'd have to go to some Ivy League professor of fertility, and he's going to explain it to you. And guess what? It's in the book. Because again, any phenomenon that's on earth must be in the blueprint. So when they went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, Alav Shalom, and they said, Rabbi, we have Siamese twins, and we want to split them. But if we split them, there's a chance that one of them is going to die. What is the law? I don't know. I don't have no pisukim in my Torah. It talks about Siamese twins. Yeah, a couple of, we have twins in the Torah that were born. But Siamese twins, where are you going to open? Which book is going to talk about splitting Siamese twins on the risk that one of them might die? Guess what? Rav Moshe answered the question from Torah sources. And you start to see all the questions that are asked our rabbis today regarding identifying somebody through DNA. There was no DNA technology at Har Sinai. I'm sure Moshe had been a new DNA, but it wasn't as rampant as this today. And Hakamim found sources for everything. So what do you see from here? Hazaka Berucha. That you see from over here, that the new phenomenons are addressed in the Torah, you just have to find it. You just have to access it. So basically what I'm telling you, there's no question that a rabbi will answer you and say, the Torah doesn't talk about it. Impossible. Impossible. If it exists, it must talk about it. Now the rabbi might say, hey listen, I'm not so fluent to know where to find it in the book, because this is a blueprint that's 10,000 pages long. That's why we have to send this question to the bigger rabbis. That's why we usually send these type of questions to the Gadol. Because the Gadol Ador knows the whole 10,000 pages by heart. So he's able to figure out, hey, it's similar to this case, it's similar to that case. And they're able to present the situation. So therefore I say Hiddush now. The Constitution, that's a book of the past. It constantly needs to stay current with the current society. But if you ask me, our Torah, it's not a book of the past, it's progressive. Progressive means it already is dealing with stuff that hasn't been yet revealed to us. It's already futuristic. The Torah is not behind the time. The Torah is actually ahead of its time. And therefore the Pasuk says, Ve'elle ha-mishpatim, these laws of the Torah, remember, Asher tasim lifnehem, the law that I'm giving you is ahead, it's progressive, it's lifnehem. And therefore, you don't have to worry about updating it and amending it and changing it. Already, God says, I took into consideration lifnehem, what's going to be in front of them. All the phenomena that's going to be ahead of the world already in this book, already it exists. That's that should give you a lot of respect. Most people would say, who do you have more respect for? You see some kollel guy from the Mir Yeshiva, walking with his old Aramaic text, and then you see some professor coming out of Harvard with his book. Of course, the professor from Harvard would get more respect because of his status. But if you look at the curriculum that the boy from the Mir Yeshiva is sitting and learning and reading, he's reading the secrets of the world, he's reading the blueprint of creation. He has the truth in his hand. He has the divine law, not law that was written by a scientist that today is written and tomorrow is refuted. And the next day they change their mind. Ladies, I'd like to say one more interpretation. This is to be the fifth interpretation. We don't like to do things in five. Maybe I'll say a sixth. But this is the fifth. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifneihem. Mishpatim, the word mishpat refers to judgment. In Hebrew we call mishpatim also dinim. In the Kabbalah, whenever we mention dinim, dinim means strict judgment. And we don't like dinim, we like chesed. But unfortunately, Klal Yisrael throughout its existence, especially in this last exile, which is pushing 2,000 years, had its share of dinim. A lot of judgments. just alone in the last 100 years, the destruction of European Jewry, 6 million Jews. You talk about a judgment that came down to this world like in no other generation. And that's only, I take that back, was only would minimize it. That's one of many tragedies that took place in this last exile. The Spanish Inquisition is one. The pogroms that took place in Europe is others. And the anti-Semitism that's still around today in Europe is part of all this process of judgments. This exile is filled with dinim. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avot, Evu mitunim badin. When you see God's judgments, be patient before you jump to conclusions. Before you start to question God, Evu mitunim badin. Somebody might come along and say, what is God doing? What does God want? This is part of a process. The process of judgments ultimately bring us to redemption. I guess if somebody never saw a lady giving birth, he would probably be bewildered that right before the birth, there's tremendous pain. And the lady is screaming, and she's in pain, and they have to give us sedatives. And somebody would say, what is this over here? But the person who knows says, this is a good thing. These screamings and these pains over here is going to bring a baby to the world. This is the prerequisite. And the louder the screams get, that means the closer the baby is from emerging. Of course, you would know that better from me. In any event, that's what they call the exile. As it gets to the end, they call it Hibleh Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach. As if to say that in order for Mashiach to come out of the birthing canal, it needs a lot of labor pains. And those labor pains are the pains, unfortunately, that Klal Yisrael has to suffer. Now, we don't know why that has to be that way, but that's the way it has to be in order to... So I heard once from one of the Hachamim. He said, there's a Gemara in Shabbat. This is from the Kerem Shlomo. The Gemara says in Shabbat that there were two rabbis, Hillel and Shammai. A non-Jewish fellow came to Shammai. And he told them, I want to convert standing on one leg. One-legged conversion, or whatever that means. And Shammai had no patience for him. And he took what's called the Amat HaBinyan. Amat HaBinyan is the leveler. And when they're building a wall, they put this item on the wall to see if it's straight. You know, you have the mercury going back and forth to make sure. So he had one of those in his hand, I guess, and he threw it at him. He said, get out of here. One-legged conversion. Strange that that's the item. The Gemara goes out of its way to tell us what he threw at him. What do I care what he threw at him? If it was stick at him, he threw bananas at him, we threw the Amat HaBinyan. But the Gemara goes out of its way and says, that's how we shoot him out of the Midrash. Get out of here. He took the Amat HaBinyan, he says, get lost. So he went to Hillel. And then Hillel eventually, you know, taught him what to do, and he eventually accepted him. So he says, what is this story over here of Amat HaBinyan, and what is this one-legged conversion? So he says, beautiful Hiddush, a beautiful mashal. He says, when somebody's building a house and the house is under construction, it's very dangerous if you're not part of the construction crew to go into the house at the time that they're building it. Why? Because the workers are working. They're throwing things, things are falling, things are involved, they're picking up things, they're dropping things. It's a secured area only for people that know what they're doing. If somebody finds himself under the construction site and doesn't belong there, he can get hurt. When they were building the Mir Yeshiva across the street, almost finishing it, every day I'm sitting in my office, you hear things smashing and metal cranking down and all sorts of things back and forth. Sakana to be there when they're building it. Only after it's built, then already you could enter. Then they say you get your certificate of occupancy. But before it's built, sakana, things are not stable yet. Things can fall at any time, and people are throwing things. The workers have their tools all over the place, and you could fall and get hurt. Things are not stable. You can slip. They're not tied down. The wind could come and blow a piece of wood, God forbid, and hurt somebody. So he said something amazing. Mashiach will come as God finishes rebuilding the third Beit HaMikdash. So he says, when God's rebuilding the third Beit HaMikdash, it's a work zone. And as the building of the third Beit HaMikdash, things are being thrown back and forth, and that's all the Yisurin that we're feeling. All the Yisurin is all that construction of the Beit HaMikdash, and as they're building it, there's stuff that's going to happen in order to get the building built. When they built the Verrazano Bridge, people fell off the bridge, people died. When they were building railroads, there was a lot of tragedies. When God's building His temple, so with that comes a lot of commotion. And that commotion comes to us in the form of Yisurin. But the Pasuk says, Shemru Mishpat. Be patient. Shemru means to be patient. Shemru Mishpat. Be patient when you see the judgment of God, the Asu Siddakah, because one day that Mishpat will turn into Siddakah, into goodness. Ki kirova yishu'ati lavo, because my salvation is close to come. But it's got to go through the process. You have to build a house. When you build a house, it becomes dangerous when you're building the house. But when it's finished, it's finished. This convert saw all the troubles that the Jewish people go through. So he came to Shammai and he says, listen, I want to convert to Judaism. But on one leg, which means I don't want to go through the whole process of suffering. Why can't we just do it immediately? One leg. Get it over with. Let the Mashiach come. Why do the Jewish people have to go through all this suffering? If I want to convert, you have to convince me that it's worth it. And Shammai said, you don't understand. So he took the Amat HaBinyan and he threw it at him. He says, you never went to a work site. They throw this piece to each other in order to measure. If you were in that work site, you'd get hit by it. That's part of the process of building. God throws the Amat HaBinyan all over the place in order to get the building done, and the clay sails in the way. You cannot ask for a Judaism that's al-degi lahad. The Yisurin are part of the building process. And when the building is finally done, and then Borei Olam, the Yisurin will go away, so you have to be patient. I cannot explain to you why that's part of the process, but it seems that nothing for nothing. Klai Yisrael needs to go through a purging process in order to get to the redemption. Egypt was no different. Before Moshe Rabbeinu could take them out of Egypt and get them to go through 210 years, we're going almost 10 times longer than Egypt. That's why it's very, 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 very long. But nonetheless, Shemru Mishpat, because the Mishpat will become Siddakah, Ki Korabai Yishu'ati Lavo, and this is the way the rabbi explains the Pasuk. These are the judgments. The judgments that are going to come at the time of the redemption. And the Pasuk says, Ve'elle ha-mishpatim asher tasim lifnehim. They're going to come before the final redemption. The final redemption is going to be racked, unfortunately, with mishpatim. To read his golden language, where he writes, and I quote, וזה שכתוב הפסוק, ואלה המשפטים אשר תשים לפניהם, מלשון קודם, ולפניהם means לפני, לפני means before, דהיינו שקודם הגאולה, before the redemption, תהיה מידת הדין שולטת בעולם. Unfortunately, the judgments are going to be manifest in the world. והצרות יתגברו מיום ליום, and the troubles will grow from day to day. V'inekichen, if that's the case, yesh lachush, we have to suspect ki yipilu libot b'nei adam, maybe the people are going to become depressed. The people will become despondent. She yidmeh b'inehem, they're going to think to themselves ki en ketz li me'ara'ah, the bad days are never going to end. And therefore he comes along and says, it's not the case. It's only lifnehem, it's only a prerequisite, the mishpatim. But there will come a time that the mishpatim will end. And then already we'll see that the mishpatim are actually siddakah. And then you'll see ki kirova yishu'ati lavo. So that's something that's a reality, but it's also comforting at the same time. So look at this here. We have one pasuk. And look how many ideas come from the pasuk itself. Ve'ela mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem keshuhan aruch. Set the laws up in an orderly manner. And it's connected to the altar. Because the one that will be humble like the altar, the Yosef Karo, will be the one to present the Mishpatim Nifnehem, like a Shulchan Aruch. Ve'ela Mishpatim Asher Tasim Nifnehem, Nifnehem Ve'lo Nifne Goyim. We must not take our cases to secular courts. That's like leaving the synagogue to go pray somewhere else. You must bring your cases to the Shekhinah. Ve'en la mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem, lifnehem ve'lo lifnehem malachim. The angels had a good claim. They're the neighbor of the Torah, but they weren't willing to pay full price. They can only fulfill the mishpatim esoterically. They don't have the pshat. Klai Yisrael was willing to pay all four interpretations. Ve'en la mishpatim, because of these laws that we can follow literally. Tasim lifnehem, the law belongs not to an angel, but it belongs to a man. Ve'en la mishpatim, these laws of the Torah, not like the Constitution. They endure the test of time. And therefore, it's not a regressive book. It's a progressive book. And therefore, all modern day questions can be answered in the book that was written then because it is the blueprint. Ve'ele ha-mishpatim, it is these laws asher tasim. Know that the law is lifnehem. It's ahead of its time. It's in front of them. It's lifnehem. And finally, the last interpretation is ve'ele ha-mishpatim, at the time of judgments. Strict judgments of God that are going to be the telltale sign of the generation before the Mashiach. That's a consolation that says, Asher tasim lifnehem. It's only going to be prior. But those birth pains are eventually going to lead to a birth, and that birth is going to be the birth of Mashiach Tzidkenu, Shehavu b'merah b'yameinu. Amen.